Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
Tonight we have a great show and a very special guest. Her name is Miss Jean Libby. She is.
Hello, Leslie.
How are you?
Oh, just fine. Just fine. So glad to hear you.
Right, right. We have a lot of exciting things going on this weekend. Can you introduce yourself to the audience and just tell them about this weekend and what's so exciting about this weekend?
Well, it's the upcoming weekend that's going to happen, the following weekend. And it's the 150th anniversary of the John Brown Raid in Harper's Ferry. And so that's been something I've been studying for a long time, and I'm just really happy to be a part of it.
Can you just give the audience a brief synopsis of your work?
Okay, well, I started in 1979. I published a book called Black Voices from Harper's Ferry, which was based on oral history interviews of people in Harper's Ferry who I thought might have some kind of memory from their ancestors about the African-American participation in the raid. And the way that I did that was I visited churches, and I did this the year before. And you understand, I'm white, and so I go to the black churches, and I stand up and I say, I'm looking for stories about John Brown. And what the people did was they invited me to come back, and they invited me to stay in a home with them, you know, in their homes and taking care of me. I brought a daughter with me, a 14-year-old daughter. And therefore, I had a base to work from in doing the research. And so that was the beginning of my research. It wasn't only oral history. It was documentation. And by having this base and the faith of the people in the community, I was able to keep on going. And so what I did after that, well, actually, during that time, I found a primary source, a written primary source by a black minister who had been suspected of being with John Brown. And he had to get out of town real fast or they would have brought him to Virginia and put him in jail, because his name was in John Brown's pocket as somebody who was trustworthy. So when I found this, it was, it's like no other kind of feeling. There's something that's not known, and it's in writing, and it's from the time. And so I hadn't been to school yet, hadn't been to university. I had been, a mother and taking care of my kids. That was what you did in that day. So then I went to school after that to try to understand Reverend Thomas Henry.
Okay, so now Reverend Thomas Henry, he wrote, you said he wrote something?
Yes. He was suspected of being in conspiracy with John Brown. And so when they found the carpet bag with all his letters over at the Kennedy Farm, and they found, they started going through the letters and this and that, and they found his name, Reverend Thomas Henry, that he was a trustworthy colored man. And it had been published before, not his words, but the fact that he was in the letter had been published by Professor Benjamin Quarles.
I heard
it. You know Professor Quarles, and you know of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is the black historian who has researched so much about a lot of things, but including the John Brown raid. And so I went to Howard to look in their archives, and I looked up Reverend Thomas Henry, and his autobiography was right there. So he wasn't lost. We were.
Wow. That's awesome. Now, what made you become interested in this subject? 1979, there was a lot. Wasn't as much as was going on as it was in the 60s. But what prompted you to say, I want to go to these black churches and I want to interview these people?
Well, during the 60s, I was involved in the civil rights movement in California. And so I wrote the periodicals, the newsletters, and the press releases and that for CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and then for our local branch of the NAACP.
Okay. And, so, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, when I say our local branch, I live in Palo Alto, California, which is right next to Stanford University, and so Stanford University was sending all these people to the South. And they also had these faculty members and ministers who were attached to the church who were the civil rights activists of the 1960s. And so the branch of the NAACP collected more funds for the national organization than any other branch in the country, because people around here, they supported civil rights.
The history of Stanford, that they would get involved in the civil rights movement and start this crusade that you're now involved with, and it's continuing all these years later.
Well, it's a private university like Harvard, and certainly a wealthy university. Were people who, I think it's just a combination of people like the abolitionists in New England, who are inspiring each other, and then they began to sponsor people who would go to the South and who would be arrested in the Freedom Rides. So they would be part of these people who were faculty members at Stanford and students at Stanford were going, and they were putting their lives on the line with the African Americans in the South in the Freedom Movement. And so the more that you know about that and know people, we would have meetings, and someone would come who had been in jail in Louisiana, for example, and he would talk about being in jail, and he would talk about being beaten. We became a part of it, because then we would sponsor, food drives, clothing drives, assistance to people who were in the South, and the main assistance that was needed was bail money.
I see.
Yeah. So
you guys are really working in John Brown's spirit on the campus of Stanford University in the 60s. So.
Yes, I was part of the movement, but I'm just a housewife. My husband had been a librarian at Stanford. By this time, he'd moved to the public library. He's a reference librarian. So I'm the community, but not really part of Stanford.
Now let's talk about the work of John Brown.
Okay, his father wasn't a minister. He was just an abolitionist. There were a whole lot of people who were anti-slavery in the late 1700s, right after the American Revolution, who lived in Connecticut. And they moved together to Ohio. It wasn't Ohio then. You know, it's not even a state yet. And John Brown was 5 years old. And his father and mother, and he's got an older sister and two younger brothers. So if you can imagine, they moved 400 miles from Connecticut to what is called the Western Reserve, and it's now called Ohio. And they
was that part of the Northwest Territory?
Yes, yes. And so slavery is not allowed there.
Right.
And that's very important in John Brown's history, because every time he's doing something and moving forward with his plans and his abolition plans, it's in response to slavery becoming more part of more legitimate in the United States.
And specifically in his community.
Well,
was he being, you know, ran out of these, you know, was his family being chased out of Massachusetts because of slavery?
No.
Were they,
I know
a lot of Quakers were moving around trying to get away from it.
Well, the abolitionists who came to Ohio were definitely more radical than those who remained. But they weren't chased out. I mean, they were definitely the people who stayed behind were the more conservative, don't want to rock any boats, and a lot of them making their money on slavery, too, because, you know, they're the ship owners in New England. They're the cotton manufacturers. So the people who moved to Ohio are definitely more radical than those who remain. But what they do then is they establish the Underground Railroad in connection with Frederick Douglass and the black abolitionists. And so they're cooperating from Ohio, from Massachusetts, from New York, and they're cooperating with the people who are in the who are the black abolitionists and the women like Susan B. Anthony and Lucy Stone. They're all working together to help people get out of slavery.
Now, you know what's amazing to me is the fact that you said that they traveled 400 miles from Massachusetts to live in Ohio, a territory deemed slave free,
right?
Because of the founding fathers or the framers of this country, they deemed all new territories would not be allowed to have slaves in a new territory. So they chose the Northwest Territory as a strategy, and to move 400 miles and then to be able to communicate successfully to other abolitionists all over the country is amazing to me as far as their network ability. You know, we have Skype today, we have YouTube and all sorts of technology. But it seems that today we cannot surpass the technology that they had.
You're right. They had no fax machines.
I don't know how they did it, and they were so successful. But I just wanted to bring that point up, and if you could add to it, you know, just it was amazing how John Brown had all these friends.
I think that's really a good one, you know, because you do have to think about that, that the lack of technology at the time and how much they stayed connected to each other. And a lot of it is the newspapers. There's Frederick Douglass's The North Star, And he also has Martin Delaney working as an editor of the North Star. And they travel all around talking about anti-slavery and also with subscriptions for their papers. So there's The Liberator, which is by William Lloyd Garrison, a white man. There's more subscribers to The Liberator who are African Americans than there are white people.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was amazed at that too. So they're often the press, the anti-slavery and press and the African American press, which is just starting at this time. It's so exciting, you know, people are writing and publishing and doing all these things. And so this is often a way that they communicate together, because Douglas and Delaney and people like that are traveling all around all the time.
Were they able to take advantage of the physical train and railroad? Because I know the technology helped them move their messages across the country. Did that have an important role? I studied recently about Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and he was a postmaster.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very important high-tech position at that time. How influential was the post office in that, and connecting people to one another, these newspapers getting?
That is so cool. And just as kind of an aside, John Brown was a postmaster appointed by John Quincy Adams in this little town in Pennsylvania where he lived when he was a younger man.
I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised, because I'm an electronics teacher and I love technology. And I'm looking, when I study history, I try to find the parallels. And when I found out that Lincoln was a postmaster general, something to that nature, I said, you know, that was a high tech position at the time. And I also read that the anti-slavery movement used, as you said, a lot of literature, and the slave system used to burn down these post offices because they suspected that those messages were being sent through the post offices. It truly means something when you hear how active they literally were with their messages and their networking and taking advantage of technology. And when you said Stanford is an icon for technology,
mm-hmm.
that university. But I didn't know that it was part of the civil rights movement.
Oh yes, very very important part. But your question about John Brown and the railroads is a super cool one, because yes, he's involved in technology. He's involved in going on the railroads. He wants the most modern weapons. He gets the Sharps rifle, which is just being invented, and which is a faster loading rifle. So when he has that weapon with one man, it's the same as having 20 members of his army. People say he was crazy to have such a small army. He had the most modern weapons. He rode the trains, and something else he did, which is in this lovely new book that Alice Kesey McCoy mentioned on her interview yesterday by Louis DeCaro. And this book talks about how John Brown rode the steamers on the lakes. And so you can go from New York to Ohio in one day because you're crossing the lake on a steamer. You can't do that now. You can't drive from New York to Ohio in one day. But they had these steamboats.
I don't know what a steamboat is. What is?
Okay, it's there's in traveling on the canals, which were built before the railroads.
Okay.
And along the lakes, a steamboat is a method of transportation ahead of trains that gets people and goods across the water. So it goes from when the Erie Canal is built, you can take a steamboat, and the steamboat can go across Lake Erie much faster than you can go on a train or by road. And they don't have these steamboats anymore, because after trains came, and then especially after automobiles came, the steamboats were antiquated. They don't carry that many people. Trains carry many, many more people. And but at John Brown's time, he's using them.
Wow.
And so what Lou DeCaro has done that is so, you know, that is so lovely is he studied the schedules and he's found that this is where John Brown writes his letters. He's getting on the steamboat and he's going on his trip over from Ohio to New York or New York to Ohio, and he can sit down at his ease and write a letter. And that's where he did a lot of his work. And then as soon as the trains come in, he's using them too, because it was necessary to get food with guns during the late 18th century and early 19th century. For ordinary people to get food, you had to shoot it.
Okay.
There's not, you know, there's not refrigerated cars, there's not processors. You provide the food for your family. And so, yes, ordinary people had had guns. They had to, not only for protection, but for food. But this is a big issue with John Brown, because he's a weapons man.
Okay.
There were many abolitionists who were pacifists. And,
nonviolent? Is that another word for pacifist?
Yes. Yes, and who believed that that because John Brown advocated an attack, a physical attack on the slave power with guns, with arms, that he has his solution to the problem of slavery and to get rid of it is with arms. And so that's a big division in the abolitionists, and there's something really big that changes that.
Yesterday, I interviewed your dear friend.
Yeah, Alice Kesey McCoy.
Yeah, I would never remember Alice. Yeah. Alice talked about his involvement, John Brown's involvement, the Bloody Kansas or Bleedy Kansas.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Okay.
It's so, not small. It's not small. It's the beginning of the Civil War. And this is also what makes abolitionists decide whether or not it is right to use arms, because what happens in Kansas is the United States government passes a law that says that the new territories can vote, the people in the new territories can vote whether or not slavery is legal. This is in 1854. This is after they've passed other things, you know, like the fugitive slave law that says that a slaveholder can pursue someone who is enslaved anywhere in the United States and the territories. All he has to do is get a warrant from a southern judge or a southern sheriff, and he can go anywhere he wants to in the territorial United States, whether they're slave or free, to pursue the people they call fugitives and we call freedom seekers. So this is what's setting up the conflict in the United States. And John Brown is for defense in the federal government. The slave power wanted to keep control of the federal government, and they were able to gain control. It had been balanced before. There was compromise and compromise, but it was pretty well balanced. And then, beginning in 1850, the balance shifts to the slave power having the federal control.
What did the Underground Railroad have an effect on the slavers making decisions to reverse all of these laws and to go against the Constitution? Weren't they suffering from all the freedom seekers escaping? Were they not being hurt financially? And they passed this fugitive slave law as a way to go back and repossess, quote, their, what they thought of as their property, because they were losing slaves by the hundreds of thousands.
Certainly. In fact, the governor of Virginia states this. He says, you know, the whole state of Virginia is just like a sieve, you know, that you pour your water through. People are escaping so much, and if only they have to go to Ohio and they're free, then of course more will go. So then they pass the law that says, well, you can follow people to Ohio and you can arrest them And if you help them, the people who help them are liable for arrest and fines, too. And this gets those Yankees mad.
Was there a lot of physical altercations?
Yes.
As a result of the Southerners, the slavers coming into the North and trying to kidnap people they deemed fugitives?
You bet. You bet. And that's the history. I mean, that's the history that's so exciting. And John Brown is involved with these people who are doing the physical rescues. Harriet Tubman, he's with her. And he looks for her. He seeks her out. The people who are called his Secret Six, the reason he finds them is they've been involved in slave rescues. Oh, it's such an exciting history. And we have it. You know, this is the history of our country. For a town to help someone, of course, the people who are doing the rescuing can't succeed unless the whole town is assisting, unless they won't be stopped by other authorities or by people saying, you know, it has to be everybody. So one of those towns was Oberlin, Ohio, who participate all together in a rescue. Syracuse, New York is another. There are a great many, and there are more in the North. Detroit, oh, what Detroit does is incredible. There's a whole group called the African Mysteries.
The African Mysteries?
African Mysteries, and they are the Underground Railroad in Detroit. And Detroit is very important because if you get there, it's real easy to get across to Canada. So John Brown and others are involved in making the routes going west so that they can get people to Detroit. And you can't, even a big place like Detroit, you can't succeed unless there's a lot of people in the town, in the city, that you can count on not to turn you in, not to call authorities. And you have to be able to count on the authorities, too. There's towns in Iowa, Grinnell, Iowa, where there's a university now, and the whole town declares, you know, this is a safe place for you to come. We're not going to help slave catchers.
When we talk about these towns getting involved, and I think it's a great segue from John Brown, where we see a man, just one individual, you know, leading a raid. Then we have Harriet Tubman, and we have, you know, a sprinkle of other abolitionists. Now, when these uprisings occurred, did they receive national attention legally? Did that ever happen in history as far as your studies?
Yes, but it's the same issue that you brought up at the beginning, and that is they didn't have the technology of a national news at that time. There's a lot of newspapers that are being published in one place or another, but there's no transmission until telegraph, and then trains help this too, because then you can bring the newspapers by train to other parts of the country. But the publicity that would be given would be very local, unless there are powerful newspapers such as in New York, the Daily Tribune, and there are also powerful newspapers who support slavery.
Right, right. Now, and what I was trying to draw from you is I know of some stories where the governors had to get involved with, for instance, in Philadelphia with William Steele, the famous case of Jane Johnson. Governors had to get involved in find peace and a compromise to pay the slaver,
mm-hmm.
and then allow the freedom seeker to continue on and live as a free woman.
This is Brenda. How are you doing, Jean?
Hey.
One of the things that, from my perspective, Jean, was that John Brown actually evolved. And while he did a number of things to help freedom seekers, there was a point where he just wanted to end slavery completely. And to me, that's the significance of Harper's Ferry. Do you see that sort of evolution with this entire group that was at Harper's Ferry?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Because they had all been actively involved in helping people, individuals. But it seems like they were frustrated because while they were helping us, the whole institution kept growing.
Do you think that the bloody Kansas was like one of the straws that broke the camel's back? I know that Alice mentioned yesterday that it was so far away from his rate, as far as time, that it might not have been. But what do you think was one of the things that said, you know, that's enough is enough. This is what we're going to do.
Yes, well, I'd like to say a little more to Brenda here because that's a really important point.
Okay.
Now, your relative, Brenda, is John Copeland.
Yes.
And he was involved in the rescue of John Price in Oberlin.
Yes.
And so John Brown and his men, his, you know, the people who are working with him, go to search him out. Because they've heard of him, and they know, in fact, they find him in jail. So they go to deliberately to the people like John Copeland who have been active in slave rescues. And that's another way that the people are coming together. He goes to deliberately to Reverend Jeremiah Logan, for example, in Syracuse, who's been active in a slave rescue. He goes there, goes to him and says, hey, would you, you know, what do you think of this? Would you be a part of this of this movement? So it's the whole rescuing of people, of the freedom seekers, and he goes after them, he finds them.
So they were the opposite of what you would call the bounty hunters. So you know, the slavers were organized, and they had bounty hunters to go look for fugitives. And on the opposite side, we had people like John Brown and John Copeland who had a reputation to go out and seek someone who had been kidnapped. Is that what I'm hearing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this was these people were on a mission. This is what they did.
Right. Well, in fact, a lot of the people who, I believe it was four or five of the men who fought at Harper's Ferry actually fought with John Brown in Kansas.
Oh, yes.
Could you go into that in detail? Because that is an exciting story to me. When you say, see, I thought Kansas, I thought it just erupted, you know. I didn't know this was, that it was an organized battle until yesterday when I was talking to Alice. So could you ladies go into how this Bloody Kansas came about and how John Brown and John Copeland got involved?
Now, for Kansas, first we have the governmental act, which is throwing out the ordinance that says there can't be any slavery in the Northwest Territory. And so this governmental act says that the people who settle in Kansas and Nebraska will be able to vote whether or not the state is slave or free.
Disregarding the ordinance, which was the Northwest Ordinance, which was written in the 1700s.
And disregarding the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which said that states could not be admitted, new states could not be admitted from the territories unless it was balanced one slave and one free.
Okay.
So they're throwing all of that out. And so the war that starts is that people come to settle in Kansas who will want to vote not to have slavery in the state. And there are more people, and there are also people who will come who will want to vote to have slavery in the state.
Is that their sole purpose of moving to that area?
Yes.
Was to vote?
Yes. And to settle a new place to... I mean, it's a new world. This is pioneering, but it's very difficult to do. And I mean, the place is cold. They've got to build everything. They've got to start growing their crops. And the only way that they can do it is to have assistance from home. Now, the people who are in support of slavery don't come in such numbers. What they do is they send people called the border ruffians, who are actually mob, and they go to where the election is held, and they tear up the ballot boxes. They have murdered people who are the settlers coming in to vote for a free state, and there's just chaos what's going on. John Brown is the first person to counter the terrorism that's being inflicted by the Missourians.
Border ruffians.
Yeah, the ruffians. They are from Missouri. In fact, they're led by a former senator named David Acheson. And so they come across in armed groups. Missouri is right next door to Kansas. They can come across. They can go back. And they have also the settlers who are there are doing murder, ambush murder of the Free State settlers. And they are also going to attack the town of Lawrence, which is where many of the Free State settlers have come. So John Brown's grown children, about four of his sons and their wives and their families, are these settlers, some of these settlers, in 1854.
Oh, I didn't know that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that's why he comes. They write him in 1855. He's back in New York in North Elba, you know, with his family there. And they write him, and they said, we need guns because these people are shooting us. And so he comes with the guns himself, and he is willing to both defend against those who would come, and they do. They come in and they break up the houses, they have little stores started, and the ruffians and the pro-slavery people come in. And they have the law behind them, because when the election came, that's called the bogus election, it was made, a constitution was made that said, you cannot even speak against slavery in Kansas. It's a crime.
Wow.
This is going to be a slave state.
What role did Charles Sumner play in this entire debacle of an election? You know, what happened in Congress when this was going on? How did Congress respond?
Well, there begins to be debates about, you know, what's happening because of the election, you know, the ruffians coming across and taking over the elections and killing people and this and that. And so Charles Sumner, who is the senator from Massachusetts, has a speech called The Crime Against Kansas. And he actually publishes this speech before he speaks it on the floor of Congress. And it's a 4 hours long speech, if you can imagine, in which he's stating all of these things that have happened and how the Kansas-Nebraska Act is not working and that there is a crime against Kansas. And there's a congressman from South Carolina who is offended by this speech. And the reason he's offended is because Sumner speaks personally about some of the supporters of the slaveocracy in Congress. And so he goes in after Congress has adjourned, after Sumner has made his speech, and he beats him to unconsciousness with a cane that he has especially made for this. And so Sumner is brought to the hospital, and he's very near death. And this all happens at the same time that the Missourians, under a former senator, David Acheson, who's been brought out of office, are attacking Lawrence. So if you're on the side of the abolitionists, which I am, I think these two events are coinciding. I think that the Missourians know that this attack is going to be made on Sumner.
Mm-hmm.
They certainly know about the speech because he's published it ahead of time. And so they're coordinating their move, which is to go in and take over the town of Lawrence. Now, what happens in Lawrence is very significant in relation to John Brown. He is a captain of a militia company, you know, for self-defense of the various communities. And they know that the Missourians are coming to Lawrence. And so they're getting their group together, their rifle company, and they're riding to the defense of Lawrence, which is a few miles away. And then the word comes that the town fathers, the Free State settlers of Lawrence, have decided to surrender without fighting, so nobody will be killed. This really sets him off. He said, this is not the way to win a war. You fight them. Yeah. So he doesn't go, though. He goes down the settlement where he and his sons and some other people live, and he selects a group of people who have made a written death threat on them. And he and his sons take them out to the creek in the middle of the night, and they kill them by hacking them to death with broadswords. Five people.
So the people that call John Brown crazy, they really don't know that he was defending his own blood.
Right. He's defending himself. He's defending the community. What they say, what they say is that this was random. It was not random.
No.
They had made a written death threat. He selected these people. Now, these people hadn't done anything except threaten. They were not responsible for the murders that had occurred previously.
Now, was his son murdered before or after that incident in Kansas?
After.
Okay.
And so, but
now,
this is...
take us to Harper's Ferry.
Yes.
So after this Lawrence, Kansas war, how much longer did it take before the Harper's Ferry incident?
Let's see, that's September 1856. It's going to be 3 years. Because what he does in the meantime is he goes to New England and he asks for funds for arms for the settlers of Kansas. He tries to raise funds. And then when the Kansas gets settled by the federal government intervening and taking over the government and calling for a new election. And when the new election comes in 1858, which is protected by the government, then the Free Staters win.
Oh, okay.
So Kansas is settled. And so John Brown wants to move into the South. He wants to bring, as he says, at the Battle of Osawatomie, he wants to carry the war into Africa. And so he begins organizing in Canada among African Americans who have settled there, and including leadership. This is where he gets in touch with Harriet Tubman, with William Howard Day, with William Whipper in Pennsylvania. Certainly William Still is one of these. This is where he begins his organization among African Americans, and that happens in 1858.
Now, was he involved with the African American community to that extent prior to 1858, or this is...
Yes. Yes, that's one of the biggest things about John Brown, is that he was always involved with the African American community wherever he was. And it was very significant that he does this on a social level as well. When people come to his house, they eat dinner with him. He addresses them as Mr. and Mrs. His children serve them the meals.
Now, I was told by Alice that he lived in a black community, that North Elba, New York, was a black community?
Yes.
Predominantly black?
Yes. It was founded by Gerrit Smith, who had land. He was a wealthy man, and he had land, and he was using this land to get a community going of people who had been in slavery and were fugitives, plus free people, to have a cooperative farming area. So Most of the people there are black, although there is another, a white family nearby that's very significant, the Thompsons, because the Browns and the Thompsons intermarry with each other in the two white families. And then the Thompsons will also go, the young members will go to fight in Harper's Ferry, and they die too.
Well, one thing that I believe really set John Brown apart from everyone else was that it's to the point you're making, Jean, about he walked the talk, and he truly believed that blacks were his equal, unlike many abolitionists of that time.
Yeah.
Well, there were two sets of abolitionists. Do you want to talk about the ones who wanted to send blacks? They call it the American Colonization Society.
I don't know. What do you think about that, Brenda?
Well, within the abolitionist movement, there were those who, to me, if there were those who would want to send people, send blacks to Africa and settle it that way. But I
also, which blacks? Let's just clarify which blacks
the,
they want. They didn't want to send all of them, all the blacks.
Well, the freed ones.
Right, because they deemed them to be the troublemakers, right?
No, not necessarily. I think it was a matter that they didn't want to have to deal with that issue. And for me, it's a matter that in this overall scheme of things, you have, we can fight for an issue, but not really believe it thoroughly in our heart. And that's what set John Brown apart, because he truly believed blacks were his equal.
Okay, we're down to our last 2 minutes of this show.
Okay.
So we're going to have to hang up in about 2 minutes. And you, can you call back? Because I have another 45-minute show for you guys set.
All right. I'm Jean Libby, and my website is alliesforfreedom.org. That's all one word, alliesforfreedom.org.
Okay. Any email addresses or
Same deal, editor@alliesforfreedom.org.
And your latest book?
John Brown Photo Chronology.
All right, and where can they purchase your book?
On Amazon.
At Amazon, and you'll be speaking where?
In Harper's Ferry. You can get it there, too, you know,
okay,
at the commemoration.
All right, Ms. Copeland, Ms. John Copeland's descendant, Brenda Pitts, do you want to give your information? We still have about 35 seconds.